welcome to another episode of Science Chat, the science communication podcast. I'm Sean Marshall. Talking to me today is Angela Saini, award-winning independent journalist and author of Geek Nation, A Journey Through India to find out whether that country is set to become the world's next scientific superpower. I began by asking Angela what Geek Nation is about and what prompted her to write.
Well, I'm a geek myself. I come from a very long line of Indian geeks. My dad was a chemical engineer, and my parents were both born in India, but my dad in the 1970s moved to Britain because there weren't that many opportunities for engineers in India at that time, and Britain was the big engineering nation. And in the time between that happening, me being born, me myself going to engineering college, everything seems to have changed. And I think particularly in the last 5-6 years, India is really moving out of the phase of just producing generic technologies and having kind of a big science and engineering workforce, which is, it has always had, to really being innovative. And since there were no books on science in India out there for a big, for a kind of mass popular audience, I thought it's a perfect time to be chronicling these changes. And so I really wanted to do it. It was just the bug got me, and I had to write the book.
So it's really to look at how India is moving towards being a scientific superpower.
Yeah, well, the subtitle of the book actually was written by my publishers, the marketing team to be specific. So I'm not sure that totally reflects what the book is about. It's less about how India is already becoming a scientific superpower and more to do with the idea that it has aspirations in that direction, and really is throwing in all the ingredients into the mix to make sure that it happens.
So I presume you see this as a strategic move by the Indian government. Why do you think they would have chosen to develop India in this way?
Well, even at the dawn of Indian independence in 1947, India's first prime minister after it gained independence from the British, Nehru, was a science graduate himself. And he really believed, and at that time it was a very common belief across the world, that science could have a transformative power over a country's economy and socially as well. So there were, you know, America was doing it. The Soviet Union, of course, had these grand plans to use big technology to develop itself very quickly, and India was no exception. The difference is India has really stuck to those ideals, those early ideals that were set out in even in its constitution. So if you look at the Indian constitution, it contains this line that Indians should develop the scientific temper. So this idea that people should use science in their everyday lives, that science should be supported and engineering should be supportive, and that it can really change the way a country works, has been part of Indian history for the last 60-70 years, which is quite incredible. I don't know of any other country where that's the case.
Do you think that this will be as successful as the Indian government would like?
I'm not sure. It's always difficult to tell. China and India are these two economies that the whole world is watching right now, just because their growth rates are phenomenal and we're waiting to see what happens next. At the moment, it's pretty not mundane what's happening, but I mean, the growth is huge, but they're not producing amazing inventions, and they're not, it's not as though Bangalore, for example, is like Silicon Valley in the same way. It's not producing the Googles or the Microsofts, but you can see the shoots of innovation all over the country. That's what I wanted to reflect in the book, show examples of where things are really happening that are unique and truly innovative and truly original. So I don't know whether it will definitely happen. I don't know if India will become the scientific superpower that it dreams of becoming, but it is certainly on the route to doing it.
And do you think that so far you've seen evidence of this transformative power over the economy and over society as well?
Yeah, it's happening very slowly. I think the best example, perhaps, is electronic governance. So in the UK, for example, any time that the government has tried to digitise a public body or a public piece of work, if you like NHS records, or try to introduce identity cards, it's almost always failed, just because it is really difficult. It's difficult on that kind of scale to make a bureaucracy electronic, and yet India's already doing it. Part of the reason is that it does have a huge engineering workforce who happen to be very skilled and very cheap. But also because if you look at the last 30 years, Indians in the IT industry, a lot of their job has been to work on the IT systems in the West. So they've gathered all this amazing expertise from all around the world, and now they're bringing it to bear in a social context. So the government is using these very same people to digitize the government, which, on the surface at least, and its early days, is making things more transparent. India, of course, is a very famous bureaucracy, not just for being very tangled, but also being quite corrupt. And digitizing it seems to be making it more transparent, shortening waiting times, and just making things much easier for the general public. And I think once that process is complete, we'll see a real transformation in the way India works. And that's just one example.
Do you think that the success of India will have any effect on smaller countries who have been trying to develop their own knowledge economy, like Ireland, for instance?
Well, I think in a knowledge economy, just like in any other market, the people who produce the best products and the best ideas are the ones who get ahead the fastest. So I think the challenge is not so much to keep the poorer countries down in order for the smaller countries to succeed, but we all live in an ecosystem. If there are good ideas out there, then they benefit everybody, I think. And certainly, I think India's growth as a knowledge power, and China's as well, I think will be good for the whole world, because it will create a more fertile ecosystem for everyone. I mean, the key for countries like Ireland, and also for England, actually, which I think is suffering at the moment in terms of research investment, the key is to keep up by training graduates, not by raising university fees and putting caps on immigration, which stop good workers from coming in, but to embrace that economy and be a part of it, and understand that if you're going to compete in that, you need to be able to absorb ideas and act quickly, which I think maybe Britain and Ireland suffer a bit on.
How easy is it for a deeply religious country like India to reconcile those religious beliefs with being a scientific society?
Yeah, that was a weird thing for me. Even in my own family, my dad is very much a rationalist. My mum is quite religious, but religious in a strange way, in that she embraces lots of ideas and she's very superstitious. And I think that sums up really what India is like as well. You get extremely religious people and religious groups and huge displays of faith. And at the same time, you have all these hundreds of thousands of engineering and science graduates every year coming out of the universities. So it seemed like a paradox to me. But that's India. Somehow they make it work. You meet scientists there who are very religious and at the same time do great work in the laboratory. Maybe it's the nature of religion there. It's not, I mean, Hinduism, for example, tends to be a bit less dogmatic. So it's quite flexible in that way, and it maybe allows people to be practicing scientists and not worry so much about what they believe. But then again, there are clashes happening. You see it already that, especially in among some Hindu scholars, they feel uncomfortable that science is providing the answers that they used to provide. There are gurus who claim to perform miracles in India, which fly in the face of science, and those kind of areas in which science and religion collide, I think, are where people need to be extra careful. Although it's happening. I mean, for example, just this week, we saw the death of Sai Baba, who's a very famous guru in India. And he had always claimed to perform these huge miracles. And when he died, I mean, given the extent of his support around the world, he has millions of followers around the world. And yet, even after he died, you could see people, I saw people on Twitter and on Facebook and online, you know, questioning his legacy and saying, you know, he wasn't really a guru at all. He was just like a fake miracle man. So there is this kind of questioning culture coming in. People aren't as willing as they used to be, maybe, to just swallow pseudoscientific ideas, which is good. It shows that India is becoming a much more rationalistic society.
How well has your book Geek Nation been received in India?
I just finished the tour of India about 2 weeks ago, so I went to 5 cities. The weird thing is that every city is so different. So Delhi, which is in the north, the capital, is people were more interested in me rather than the book. They wanted to know whether I was married and, you know, what my favourite fashions were. Whereas in the south, in some cities like Chennai, they were more interested in the religious aspects. In Kerala, they were more in Kolkata, they were more interested in the writing style because it's a very literary city. And in Bangalore, obviously the IT geeks came out in force to listen to my ideas. But everywhere I went, pretty much every event I did was packed out, which was thrilling. It was amazing to see that so many people turned up. And it's been, there are lots of different kinds of bestseller lists in India. It's not a very scientific means of collecting information, but The Hindu, which is one of the largest newspapers, has put Geek Nation at the top of the non-fiction bestseller list for the last 2 weeks, which is good. And I'm getting great feedback from readers as well, which is really lovely.
I'm sure while you were writing the book that you met some very interesting people. Are there any that stand out particularly?
Well, I met some really weird and wonderful characters, definitely. One that I think always sticks in my mind, and I guess just because she was so inspirational, was there's a chapter in the book about tuberculosis research. There's a researcher in Chennai whose name is Sujata Narayanan, and she has devoted her life to TB research. And tuberculosis kills 2 Indians every 3 minutes. It's incredibly voracious illness. And there hasn't been a new cure for it for something like 40 years. So researchers working in this area, it's almost, what they're doing is almost futile. It's so difficult, the kind of work that they do. But she couldn't find any volunteers, healthy volunteers, to give sputum samples for her tests. She has lots of people with TB giving samples because they're patients and they come in all the time. But she didn't have any healthy ones, so she started doing tests on herself. And one day, when she took the tube out and she cultured the results, she found evidence of TB bacteria, which suggested to her that she might have accidentally infected herself in the course of doing her work. And it was devastating for her. For 6 months, she had to take a cocktail of drugs to cure herself of it. And she said to me that it triggered a latent diabetes in her. And that was a cost that she paid for her research, and yet she was totally willing to do it. I just thought it was so inspirational that a woman loved her work so much and was so committed to it, and so committed to the idea of curing people of this horrible disease that she was willing to run the risk of catching it herself and put her life on the line.
I guess when you meet people that committed, it does show why India has such a good chance of becoming successful as a scientific superpower.
Yeah, that's what stunned me, especially that, you know, even big IT moguls who, you know, have billions of dollars and can afford to retire and go to a tropical island, even they were committing themselves to trying to solve India's problems. And India does have lots of social and economic problems. And that was just incredible. I mean, it's very rare in the UK to meet scientists who have such a social outlook, I think. Often I do in the course of my work, but in India it was just amazing how common that is.
It's almost like everyone is working towards a common goal, which is something that you don't see so much in countries like Ireland and the UK.
No, I mean, sometimes I think perhaps if you live in a wealthier country, the poverty is not in your face all the time, so you're not confronted by it. But in India, you can't get away from it. If you're a scientist, you encounter it every day. And I guess the nature of being a scientist and engineer is that you wanted to solve those problems.
Well, on that note, I'd like to thank you, Angela, for talking to Science Chat today.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for another episode of Science Chat. You can find out more about Angela on her website, www.angelasaini.co.uk. Geek Nation is available in all good bookshops as well as online through Amazon, WH Smith, Blackwell and Waterstones. And as usual, you can find out more about Science Chat and this episode on www.sciencechat.net/WordPress.